So I was thinking about it. Obviously, there is like the one portmanteau that dominated this year, which was Barbenheimer, Barbie plus Oppenheimer. But if you were to pick another like two movies to put together and a name that would be the thing that everyone had to see at the theaters, what would be the portmanteau of your selection?
Let's try Anatomy of a Zone.
Ooh. Right. Or Anatomy of a Killer Moon is good.
Mm-hmm. Killers of Interest. Of course, that's that's my job description. Rimshot. Okay. Moving on.
Anne Hornaday, the killer of all things interesting.
That's right. I'm here to just...
Ouch. Before we go any further, I'm Martine Powers. It's Thursday, March 7th. This is Post Reports, and we are here talking about the Oscars that are taking place on Sunday night. Obviously, the biggest night in the film industry, the night where people are going to argue a lot about which movies were wronged, which movies were egregiously celebrated. And while I'm interested in talking about the Oscars, I'm just more interested in talking about these 10 movies that are Best Picture nominees, because I think they're, at least the ones that I've seen, are really interesting movies. But here we have today with us two of my wonderful colleagues, Anne Hornaday, movie critic for The Post. Anne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also calling in to us from Boston is Janice Page, the movies editor for The Washington Post.
Great to be here.
And Janice, I understand that you also have a couple of sub-guests
yes.
with you.
Yes, in honor of Anatomy of a Fall and the great dog performance in that, I have my dogs Mochi and a guest dog Halva here.
Oh, great. Well, if we hear from them, we will know what's going on in the background. I want to start by talking about two movies that I think dominated this year, movie-wise, more than any others. This is, of course, Barbie and Oppenheimer, both of which came out last summer. And I just have to start by saying that I feel very over talking about both of these movies, mm-hmm. just because they were such a like big moment, I guess, 6 months ago. But I'm curious, like, when you look at Barbie and Oppenheimer and how much attention there were to these movies, how much do you think that is translating now or like relevant now? How much do you think that's going to be playing out in the Oscars? And how much do you guys actually still care about these movies?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like I've been talking about these movies, to your point, Martine, just forever. And I'm almost on fumes now in terms of like what is left to say
yeah.
about them. But then I do think, though, that almost underplays how important they were. You know, obviously, they were important in terms of getting people into theaters after the pandemic. I mean, I think that it was just such a jolt, a needed jolt, not just economically, but culturally, you know, to prove that movies can still be that thing, you know, that mass cultural collective moment that we all share and just have a blast at. I just think it's exciting that two such bold original visions just did so well with global and general audiences. I mean, that's incredibly encouraging.
Janice, what do you think?
Yeah, it was really exciting. And I think its curse was also its blessing, right? Because I do think that we don't talk enough about them as movies anymore because of the moment that they captured and how they captivated us and the entire cultural, you know, sway that happened there. But they were amazing movies, and you can find fault with both of them in various ways. But the idea that they collided to such different movies in a summer moment was really extraordinary.
But are either of them Best Picture material?
I think Oppenheimer certainly is. I mean, I had my quibbles with Barbie, and frankly, as much as I laughed all the way through it and adored so much of it, I don't think it's a perfect movie. I think it's baggy. I don't think the Will Ferrell material necessarily works. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can take issue with some of her directorial choices. I feel like it's one of those movies that really would have benefited from one more pass, you mm-hmm. know, through, we would have said, the typewriter several years ago. But, you know, one more pass through the, just to tighten it up. But it was just so delirious as a viewing experience that it sort of transcended its faults in that way. Oppenheimer, technically, I would venture, it's kind of perfect. I mean, and I've also had quibbles with Nolan's filmmaking in the past. You know, I don't always think he's coherent. You know, frankly, I think his sound mixes are often problematic. And they were in this one too a little bit, but
yeah, I still feel like I missed a third of the dialogue.
I know, it's a chronic problem.
Everything is so quiet. And
not
so
only
fast.
That, but he plays music under everything, and I just wish he'd stop it and let his actors act and talk. And because there are these guys, Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr., you're like, you don't need much more than that. Like, let them be. But it was just such an absorbing, beautifully constructed. And I did hear the dialogue in the screening. I usually have trouble with that. But in this one, it wasn't as muddy for me. And I just thought it was exquisite. You know, I thought it was beautifully executed and acted and designed. And I mean, I just was with it the whole way. So, yeah, to me, it's a classic Best Picture contender.
Hmm. And they those two movies, along with this entire sort of 10 film lineup, really, really exemplify what it is that's so great about movies or art in general, right? Which is, what value system do you put to it? Is Best Picture about, you know, the craft, the combination of the script and the directing and the acting and the story and all of it? Or do you allow for, you know, something that is done at such a high level with Barbie that is, sure, it's comedy, sure, it's fluffy, it's bubblegum, it's whatever, but it's done in such a stylistic, you know, high-level way, you can't ignore that. So that's what fascinates me about this time of year, is that people start talking about these things.
And I also think that one thing I've learned, because the Academy is still a relatively small group of people, and they're really insular and opaque. You know, it's very different, unless you're a member and you're a voting member. You know, it's like, it's kind of mysterious how they come to these decisions. But one thing I've learned from interviewing people over the years is that it is a reflection of their respect for the art form and what they consider artistic achievement. It genuinely is. But it almost has more to do with their emotional, you know, it's what got them. Hmm. It's how they felt. You know, it's that old Maya Angelou quote, people won't remember what you say, but they'll remember how you made them feel.
Well, speaking of movies that made you feel, to me, I feel like three stick out in my mind. Past Lives. Mm-hmm. I completely loved it. American Fiction and The Holdovers, I think, were all, to me, seem like these somewhat small relationship dramas that I found had a really outsized emotional impact and just stayed with you. But all of which I don't think any of them have really like risen to the top in terms of attention. But I'm curious to hear from you guys of these three movies, a little bit about what you liked of them and what stuck with you.
Oh, I guess I'm going first, Janice. Am I hogging?
You go first. You go.
I agree. I loved all of those movies. And let's start with Past Lives. Yeah.
And Past Lives, of course, is the movie starring Greta Lee. It's basically about a Korean-American woman who kind of reconnects with this childhood friend who lives in South Korea and comes to visit her. She's married to a white American guy and just like kind of plays out with like three different moments from when they were kids to when they're young adults to when they're later in adulthood, and like how this relationship evolves. And it's
right. It's the big what if. It's the what if question. You know, it's the what would have happened if I had been with him? Do I want to be, you know, it's very interior. You know, it's about this woman's conundrum. And first time film by Celine Song. It's just, as you said, it's so delicate, and it's about a reality that so many people related to. I mean, this was the movie that last summer civilians, you know, like my friends and neighbors and people would come up to me and say, oh, I just saw Past Lives. I mean, it really connected with people because I think it does dramatize a reality of life that we don't often see on screen. And it just did so with such subtlety and nuance. And I recall watching it thinking, you know, it's beautiful, but do I really care about these people? And then that ending, and I don't want to spoil it, but that ending, just, it's a ton of bricks. She has been working you this whole time in such a subtle way. And it was just devastating. And it's like, man, speaking of how it makes you feel, it's like, oh, it was just fabulous. I mean, she just did a fantastic job.
Janice, what did you think of American Fiction and Holdovers?
So I'm a little biased when it comes to American fiction because, as I sit here in Boston, it was filmed literally in my neighborhood, like down the street from me. The scenes in Brookline, Massachusetts. And then
I was trying to figure out where I was like, is that JP?
It's Coolidge Corner. For those of you who know that, the opening scene is here and many of the other shots are restaurants here. And then when it moves to the beach, it moves to the exact neighborhood my sister lives in Scituate, Massachusetts.
So
just a little bit of a personal tour for me.
And really quick, before we go any further, American Fiction, directed by Corey Jefferson, starring Jeffrey Wright. This is, I think, a comedy, or it's being described as a comedy about an author who happens to be Black who decides that because the publishing industry isn't giving him the attention that he deserves, he basically intentionally writes a bad book to make a point that publishers are interested in one kind of African-American book, Black book, and that book ends up getting a ton of attention in ways that are sort of hilarious. But honestly, what I thought was really interesting about this movie is that it feels like this kind of workplace satire comedy that is wrapped around what to me felt like the much more compelling movie, which is this like family drama that has a lot of tragedy in it.
I just really think it is smart about the ways that it is a very entertaining movie that you might see that wouldn't get nominated for Best Picture, right? Kind of a family film in ways and whatever, mm-hmm. but very good at its cultural commentary, very good at, maybe too good at going a little over top, at finding ways to be inventive. You know, I'm not sure the ending really holds or did it for me, but I enjoyed myself immensely, right? And I thought that all of the actors are terrific in that movie. Very well directed, very, very well put together. The screenplay is terrific. So,
and another first film, and like Past Lives, another really impressive first film by Cord Jefferson, and
exactly,
and a long-awaited starring role for Jeffrey Wright, who we just, you know, we've seen so much of, but he's usually in a supporting role, and this is just such a great, he's just perfectly cast.
And when someone's taking a big swing like that on a first movie, you give them a lot of leeway, at least I do, you know, you just, mm-hmm. there's room for mistakes, it's okay, mm-hmm. right? But it, you know, if I want to see a movie again, the moment I've just watched it, that's a pretty good barometer, right? That's a pretty good indicator that I not just liked it or admired it, but that there's more to be seen and heard from that. So mm-hmm. I really was enamored of that. I'm enamored in a different way of The Holdovers, Alexander
Another
Payne.
Massachusetts movie.
I was going to say,
Boston, the central plot of the
movie is like, are we going to go to Boston and like, what's going to happen when we get there?
And they shared crews, I think. They had some
Just for context here, The Holdovers is basically, it's in this like New England boarding school where a few kids are left behind with this kind of salty professor over winter break. Then they're all kind of stuck there because basically, like, nobody wants them around, and their interactions. And then there's a woman who works at the boarding school as well, the chef there or the cook or what have you, and their interactions with her. And it's just very funny, but also just this kind of, like, small drama playing out with these, like, few people who end up together over winter break. Mm.
And really just very well done stylistically with an entire kind of aesthetic that is 70s and just, you know, beautifully done.
I mean, it looks like The Graduate, right? Like, if you'd shown it to me, if I didn't know the actors, I would think that this movie was actually filmed in the 70s.
Yeah.
Right. And looks like anything you would have watched on television in the 70s as well, without falling into the, you know, mob Boston stereotypes and things. Though there's some wayward accents, but we'll leave those aside. But it's really well done. And you know, the story's pretty conventional. I'm not saying, you know, I wasn't mm-hmm. surprised, but there's a reason that Davine Joy Randolph is basically the one lock, I think, we have at the Oscars for walking away with the Best Supporting Actress Oscar. I say that, but, you know, it really does seem that way. She's won so many awards.
Yeah,
and
she's
tremendous, but her part is so well written and she performs it so well. And that's what I mean. There are just, you don't have to have everything to be a Best Picture nominee. You need some really, really good performances, maybe, or a screenplay, or just something that really touches you and resonates. You know, that film wouldn't be my picked for Best Picture, but mm-hmm. I'm very happy that it's a nominee.
Then on the opposite end of the spectrum from Past Lives, in terms of
tonal qualities.
Yeah, or relation, you know, like relationships that feel like sweet and nuanced is Killers of the Flower Moon, which is about a relationship between a man and a woman that essentially is like something evil.
Toxic, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it. This is a Martin Scorsese movie that was adapted from a book and I think was highly anticipated, and that there were a lot of efforts made to really change the scope of the book and the movie to focus much more on the American Indian community in which all of this takes place. And basically, this community is slowly, literally being poisoned by the white Americans who live there and like stand to gain financially from all these people dying. But I think there was a lot that I really enjoyed in this movie and found really powerful. There were things that I thought didn't work, but my overriding takeaway from Killers of the Flower Moon was Lily Gladstone as essentially the protagonist of the movie, or at least the good protagonist of the movie rather than the bad one. I mean, there are so many scenes that have just stuck with me of her delivering grief and suspicion and betrayal in ways that are so powerful. Mm. I'm curious what you guys thought of it.
I think two things. One, Lily Gladstone is really phenomenal in this movie, basically because of what she does with that interior monologue. But I also think, I know I speak for a lot of people, that movie is just too darn long. I mean, that movie... And I'm going to go and say the quiet part out loud. Martin Scorsese is a wonderful director who did not direct all that well for this movie. You know,
Say more, like beyond just the length stuff.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I just think there's a lot of indulgence here. There's kind of some missing of the point here with the male characters being allowed to kind of take over where other characters were so much more fascinating. I mean, I think, you know, chew scenery, De Niro and DiCaprio never met a scene they couldn't chew up and spit out. I got tired of it really quickly. And I, as much as I appreciate Lily Gladstone's performance and other parts of it, particularly the story that is at play here, I think that story gets a little lost in the magnitude of the directing with a capital D.
I don't make it a point to read the books that are adapted, you know, into movies, because if I did, I would drive myself insane. But in this case, I did read the book right before I saw the movie. And the experience of reading that book is so powerful. And the way that the author, David Graham, unspools the narrative and the mystery around what was happening in this community is so gripping and compelling. And for some incomprehensible reason, Scorsese and Eric Roth and whoever else worked on this screenplay decided to jettison that structure and just tell us right away, right out, here's what we're going to do. There's this scene with Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio where De Niro's character is basically explaining what he's doing to that community. And it just completely deflates any sense of suspense. And frankly, I think moral outrage, because then it just becomes a scheme of these two ding-dongs, you know, evil ding-dongs, really, you
evil
know. And it's just, and like to Janice's point, I found it very monotonous as well, because it was just, I just think it undercut the emotion by making that choice. And I cannot understand why they would do it. I mean, I know it's a very difficult book to adapt, and it would be, it's easy for me to sit here and throw stones, but I couldn't get over that, you know?
I mean, not that Martin Scorsese needs me to come to his defense. My understanding was that, like, basically when they were starting to plot out a movie that was a closer adaptation to the book, where there's sort of this mystery around, like, who could it be? Who's poisoning all the people in this community? That, like, once you meet Robert De Niro's character for, like, four seconds, you're like, oh, that's the bad guy.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Clearly
it's a tell.
It is him.
Yes.
And so that, like, the suspense wasn't really there. But I agree with you that, like, I feel like they went so far in the other direction where it's just, like, I find it sort of intolerable to be around Leonardo DiCaprio's character and Robert De Niro's character as they continue to like do these shady things to like further poison these people. And I was like, every scene that is not a scene with Lily Gladstone feels like
it was sadistic.
Wasted time.
Well, and then I got very distracted by the how Goodfellas maps onto this movie, because there were some scenes that really were structurally almost verbatim. You know, like there's a scene where
I have not seen Goodfellas.
We have to stop. We have to stop, and Martine has to go watch Goodfellas right now, and then we have to come back.
Convene.
Okay,
it's
we'll be back.
List of,
we'll
like,
be back
the
in 2 hours, everybody.
What? Absences in my
Martine.
Watching experience.
Martine, darling.
I know. I live in my shame.
Listen, I'm not about shaming, but I just want you to have the joy, the unexpurgated joy. But there are some scenes that to me, I just couldn't unsee it. You know what I mean? Like I couldn't unremember that. And I think this is a movie that even though I was respecting the filmmaking as I was watching it, and I was also respecting it as a part of Scorsese's ongoing oeuvre and his relationship to screen violence, which I think is changing. And I think it's changing in ways that are important. But in the fullness of time, that movie has faded for me. That's what I'm getting around to saying, is that it is definitely something I look back on and go like, yeah, that just did not work.
All right, let's take a pause there. And after the break, we're going to talk about the rest of the Best Picture nominees and what they say about Hollywood right now. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Okay, so we are here with Anne Hornaday, Janice Page, talking about these Best Picture nominees. And the one that I'm really excited to talk about, even though I actually haven't seen it yet, and part because I want to see it in theaters and I want to like see it the right way, is Zone of Interest.
Oh, yes.
Which is a Holocaust movie, a movie that takes place in or at Auschwitz or around Auschwitz, and is essentially like a domestic drama about a family who's living right outside the fence or the gates into this concentration camp. And I feel like I want to make sure I say this the right way. I think that there are obviously a lot of powerful Holocaust movies that come out. And I think many of them have a sense of like dutifulness to them, of like, this is a movie about a really important story that we need to understand, and that there's like the like importance with a capital I. But the talk around this movie, I've heard, is just like completely different. That I feel like there are all these people in my life that are like, you have to see Zone of Interest because something like weird and interesting and kind of bizarre and spooky is happening in this movie. I don't want to give much away, but I would love to hear from you guys what you both appreciated seeing this. And I know even like that opening scene had a powerful effect on you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is an adaptation by Jonathan Glazer, who is already a fascinating filmmaker. I mean, when I heard he was the filmmaker, that really intrigued me because I just think he's fascinating and his past movies have just been fantastic. I think I've liked pretty much all of them, but it's actually an adaptation of a novel by Martin Amis that was based on a true story. And Glazer and his producers researched that story and really made a movie that's much closer to the actual truth. They used real names. They actually used real buildings. And I think they used the villa that they were living in. So they actually made a whole different thing here. Yay! There it is. And to this, you know, perfectly cute. They also use dog barks. You know, the way that Glazer uses the barking dogs of Auschwitz is really brilliant. But to your point, it flies in the face of so many cliched, what we think of as quote unquote Holocaust films, those dutiful films. It's more oblique. It relies more on the moral imagination of the viewer because we never go into the concentration camp. We are always on the outskirts. We're always at this commandant's home that literally abuts the camp. And the degree of denial that is going on in that domestic household.
And talk about the sound stuff.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously I'm a sound person because this is my job to deal in sound. But, like, I feel like I hear a lot about what is happening audio-wise in that movie.
I'll let Janice take that because she is in a perfect position to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary on so many levels. The way that this movie was approached by the director, by all of the filmmakers, the sound guys and composer, everything, really is so extraordinary because they were searching for a way to bring this historical moment into the present. The camera shots are almost all from the perpetrator's point of view or focusing in on the perpetrators. What you know of the victims is usually the background. You can hear gunshots. You can hear screams. You can hear bees and other ambient sounds of nature telling you what's outside the frame of the camera. Mm-hmm. And he also used, I think it was 10 cameras, to create a kind of reality television type of dialogue, almost like, you know, in the vernacular of now, so that, in fact, he has called it Big Brother in the Nazi House, not in a flippant way, but to say that he was shooting simultaneously in different rooms of the house and people were walking through and creating this landscape. So you're watching and you're hearing and you're almost reality television-like experiencing along with this family who lives just outside of Auschwitz. You're absorbing this entire thing in a way that I have really personally never experienced.
And it also stars Sandra Hüller, mm-hmm. who also is a star of Anatomy of a Fall, which is another foreign movie, European movie, that is more of a like relationship suspense mystery. I haven't seen it, but tell me briefly about Anatomy of a Fall and where it stands in the movies that you enjoyed this year.
Oh, this is very much in my top level of films I enjoyed this year. Large part because of her, she just gives a bravura performance as this woman who lives in a chalet with her husband and their son and their dog. And it's in this covered with snow. There's snow drifts outside. There's snow on top. It's this very kind of, you know, chilly but cozy atmosphere. And she's a writer. And it turns out she's, I guess, semi-famous. You know, she's pretty well known and she's got a following and she's sort of a woman of achievement. And her husband is kind of a house husband. He's like the John Lennon. He's doing the John Lennon baking bread phase, you know, of life.
And I didn't know that John Lennon had a baking bread phase.
Oh, he certainly did. Yeah, when he was raising their little boy. But anyway, I'm digressing. But let's see. How do we want to approach the spoilerishness of this synopsis? Something happens, and it turns into a psychological thriller about their relationship, about pent-up anger and resentment. And
like, basically, did she murder him or
okay,
not?
Okay, let's just,
I mean,
yeah,
I
we'll
watched the trailer, and
okay,
that was in the trailer,
okay,
so
I'm very, I'm very chary of these things because I know how people hate spoilers. But yes, he loses his life. And it could have been taking his own life or it could have been that he was pushed out of a window. And so it hinges around, did she do it or not?
Or it could have been an accident. But that's
or an accident, true. Exactly, right. But mostly, it is just this extraordinary chance for Hüller to deliver this really nuanced performance as a woman who flies in the face of so many ideas we have about femininity and wifehood and ambition and ownership of one's own desires and ambitions. It's really fantastic. It's very intriguing.
And also, speaking of movies that are questions around femininity and ambition, selfhood, wifehood, stuff like that, the last two, I believe, on our list that we haven't talked about yet, Poor Things and Maestro.
Yes.
I saw Maestro. I enjoyed it. I don't think it, like, really stuck with me. Poor Things I haven't seen because I have gotten, I got, like, really negative vibes from the trailer. I feel like I've talked to friends who were like, I really did not like that movie. Mm. I have a sense that it's the kind of movie that I would not enjoy. But I'm just wondering if there are any things you guys want to say about either of these two last remaining films, either strong positives or strong negatives.
We have so much to say about these two films, don't we, Anne?
Oh, yeah. Thoughts really and feelings.
Do. Actually, Poor Things might be the film that is most discussed, I think, in terms of agency, female agency, and just the sort of, you know, the last third of that movie is so different from the first two thirds of that movie, which is the, you know, first two thirds are very Frankenstein quality to them, you know, really out there, really. That's not my favorite kind of movie, mm-hmm. even though it's a comedy.
Because the idea, right, is that, like, Emma Stone's character is the body of a young woman, but has been implanted with the brain of a child or a baby, mm-hmm. and then, like, she's sort of like,
and she grows up.
Yeah,
she's a child woman growing up in rapid time, so she's developing at an incredibly high, quick rate, and mm-hmm. and there's body horror. I mean, this is Yorgos Lanthimos, who is known for being pushing the envelope in
He's
many
like
ways.
The favorite,
correct?
I think what's that other movie with Colin Farrell? The Lobster. Right?
The Lobster. The Killing of a Sacred Deer, but. This is a movie, this doesn't happen very often, that I hated at the outset. Because like Jana said, I'm not a fan of horror. I'm certainly not a fan of body horror. I didn't love the premise. It was very uncomfortable to watch Emma Stone acting like this girl, you know, who's unformed and she's being controlled by her quote-unquote, you know, mad scientist inventor, who she calls God, played by Willem Dafoe. And then once the premise locked in and she starts to grow up and achieve consciousness, and then the movie changes, the aesthetic language of the actual movie changes, and it becomes really beautiful and fun to watch. And she has these travels and she takes up with this real lout played by, with lots of fun by Mark Ruffalo, who's having a blast. Then I have to admit, I went along for that ride, but I still have misgivings. I mean, it really, her whole self-discovery, this character, hinges on sex, you know, and having sex with people and sexual exploration. And on one level, sure, you know, that's certainly an important part of everyone's lives. And, you know, it's a legitimate inquiry on the part of women exploring their agency and autonomy. But on the other hand, I couldn't escape the fact that it looked a lot like a wish fulfillment fantasy on the part of these male writers and filmmakers, you know.
Like very male gazy.
Little male gazy, even though Emma Stone would tell you she was a producer of this movie. She was very much an auteur of this film, and her performance is absolutely fearless, and it's brilliant. It's so good. So I have to admit, I'm really of two minds of this, which might be appropriate to the subject matter. Like one of God's inventions, I have two brains, you know, fighting with one another. But it really was. It turned into such a different movie, and that was fascinating. And then Maestro, I actually really enjoyed it. And it's funny, I saw that was the last movie I saw at the Middleburg Film Festival last fall. It was on the Sunday afternoon, which is not usually by that time, everybody's tired, you know, and you're just like, oh, God, I don't know if I can see one more. And
yeah.
And so it's not the fairest condition under which to see any movie. And the fact that I liked it as much as I did tells me, you know, it was like it got over, you know, in a big way. And not incidentally, just because of Carey Mulligan's amazing performance as Felicia.
Oh, yeah.
It turns into her movie and she's just absolutely exquisite, just great.
Yeah, because this is the biopic of the composer-conductor Leonard Bernstein. And I found her to be ultimately, like, so much more compelling than him. And I think, like, I guess I questioned, maybe this isn't the metric by which one needs to judge a movie that's a biopic, but I feel like I came away not really being sure of, like, what Leonard Bernstein did or, like, about his career.
Yeah.
I got sort of snatches of it, but as someone who came without a lot of familiarity with his career, I don't feel like I learned that much about him, but was really fascinated by their relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that movie, Maestro, could have gone heavier on the music. I wanted more music. I wanted more of the craft.
And I have to say, I was very impressed with Bradley Cooper's direction on this. I thought he took some very big swings. And I remember, when he first did A Star is Born, there were a lot of crossed elbows, like, okay, every actor says he wants to direct, and here you go. And I remember within the first few seconds of that movie, that concert footage, the concert scene, it was like, holy Toledo, he knows what he's doing. And I had the same feeling here, like, wow, he is a good director.
Yeah. Well, so before we wrap, I want to kind of come back to this question that I've had in my mind during this whole conversation, which is like, when you look at these movies as a whole and movies that like we kind of understand to be important from this year, what do these movies together say about either where Hollywood is at, especially after a very tumultuous year with the writers and the actors strike that really derailed like the Hollywood industry for a while, but also like where we are at as a culture and the kinds of issues and tensions we want to see playing out on screen right now?
I do think that's the question that we ask ourselves or each other every year. And there's a tendency to make too much of it, right? There's a tendency to say, because the movies just came out and they seem to be saying something to us, let's add that up and talk about how they reflect us. The problem with that is that, for one thing, they're not made in the year that they come out, and they're not written in the year that they come out for the most part. So it's kind of a really weird game that we play where we're trying to do math that isn't mathing. Mm-hmm. And also because in any given year, what we choose to look at this time of year is only reflective of a very tiny slice of the movies that were made. And the wonderful thing about this year, I think, is when I look at the top, the movies that are nominated for Best Picture, I see a very diverse landscape. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of different kinds of messages, a lot of different kinds of storytelling. So not just even culturally diverse, but just what those movies are trying to say to us is really all over the place, from something as, sorry, that's my dog.
Your dog agrees.
There she goes again.
Really all over the place. That was a sigh, a pregnant sigh. What are they trying to say to us? And what those movies are trying to say to us a lot of the time is, all the way from, hey, have a good time, or here, let's borrow into some of these things and let's see what history has to tell us and how it can inform us. I really do think it's a beautiful mix this year, especially.
It's a wonderful mix. It made me so happy, and it reflected my feelings about the year in total. Like you said, that didn't include all of these, there were just so many good movies I was just so excited to tell people about, and that's a lovely thing. I do think it bears reminding ourselves that most of these, we're still at post-pandemic in terms of the pipeline and the cadence of things coming out. And I think when I glance at this list, a lot of them were a long time in the making, like I know American Fiction took a pretty long time to kind of finally get into gear. The Holdovers took a while. Certainly, Killers of the Flower Moon has been on Scorsese's to-do list for a really long time. Oppenheimer, so these are films that were really ambitious. Even if they weren't necessarily huge in scale, they were still ambitious. And they benefited from that time. I think that, whatever extra time the filmmakers and writers had over that pandemic break is to the good, generally. Mm-hmm. And then when you couple this with the fact that so many of the superhero movies this past year didn't do so great.
Yeah. I say, yeah, like that's some big tragedy.
Yeah, it's not, Martine. It's not.
Madame Web didn't do so great. Like, we're done. I feel personally affected. Yeah.
So it's sort of I like the fact that we're just seeing, like Jana said, there is such diversity and strength, and they are connecting with audiences. They might not be making $1 billion like a Barbie or an Oppenheimer, but they are connecting. And that's really encouraging. And I know that from, I try to keep up with like independent theater people, movie theaters, just like, how's it going? And they feel good. It's sort of like there was it was just a real nice pace in terms of just strong things coming through,
Even with, several months of the year kind of being dominated by the fact that, actors can be promoting these movies.
That's true. That's exactly right.
And that the fact that people are still excited about movies, even though we had this pretty big disruption this year that I think feels kind of in the rearview mirror at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to be living with the aftermath in terms of, again, that pipeline and that cadence. I think that's going to be disrupted now. And so that it would be a shame because it's just right when the movies were strong and the theaters were, you know, it's like, oh, we want that to keep going. So, but no, I mean, from the looks of this list, the medium is really strong, you know, in terms of the vision that's going into it and the energy. It's really encouraging.
Well, so for people who are listening to this saying, okay, I might have time to watch one of these movies before Sunday night, or really even after Sunday night. You have to stop seeing these movies after the Oscars. Which one would you recommend?
Oh, man, that's tough. There are so many good ones.
I will say personally, American Fiction.
That's what I would go with. That was my number one movie of the year. So
really?
I'll agree with myself and say American Fiction. But with Past Lives, a very close second.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with either of those. But for me, the movie that you must see, because it's important, because it's so well done, because there is nothing like it, is The Zone of Interest.
Good argument. Good choice.
Well, listen, thank you so much for unpacking all of this, going through a lot of movies in not so much time. And I'm just so looking forward to seeing and what you are talking about after the Oscars and how you're kind of weighing the decisions that other people made on these movies. So thank you so much for being here. Anne Hornaday is the Post movie critic and Janice Page is the movies editor for The Post. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And if you want to follow the Post Oscar coverage, we will have plenty of live reporting both on Sunday night and on Monday morning of all the aftermath. So go to WashingtonPost.com to check it out. That's it for today's episode of Post Reports. Thank you so much for listening. Today's show was produced by Ariel Plotnick, and it was edited and mixed by Ted Muldoon. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.